Meanwhile, just across the border of Vietnam, in a neighboring country, Laos, where a right-wing government installed by the CIA faced a rebellion, one of the most beautiful areas in the world, the Plain of Jars, was being destroyed by bombing. This was not reported by the government or the press. Fred Bronfman told the story in his book, Voices from the Plain of Jars. Over 25,000 attack sorties were flown against the Plain of Jars from May 1964 through September 1969. Over 75,000 tons of bombs were dropped on it. On the ground, thousands were killed and wounded, tens of thousands driven underground, and the entire above-ground society leveled. Bronfman, who spoke the Laotian language and lived in a village with a Laotian family, interviewed hundreds of refugees from the bombing who poured into the capital city of Vientiane. He recorded their statements and preserved their drawings. A 26-year-old nurse from Xian Quang told of her life in her village. "I was at one with the earth, the air, the upland fields, the paddy and the seed beds of my village. Each day and night, in the light of the moon, I and my friends from the village would wander, calling out and singing, through forest and field, amidst the cries of the birds. During the harvesting and planting season, we would sweat and labor together, under the sun and the rain, contending with poverty and miserable conditions, continuing the farmer's life, which has been the profession of our ancestors. But in 1964 and 1965, I could feel the trembling of the earth and the shock from the sounds of arms exploding around my village. I began to hear the noise of airplanes circling about in the heavens. One of them would stick its head down and, plunging earthward, loose a loud roar, shocking the heart as light and smoke covered everything so that one could not see anything at all. Each day we would exchange news with the neighboring villagers of the bombings that had occurred, the damaged houses, the injured, and the dead. The holes. During that time, we needed holes to save our lives. We who were young took our sweat and our strength, which should have been spent raising food in the rice fields and forests to sustain our lives, and squandered it digging holes to protect ourselves. One young woman explained why the revolutionary movement in Laos, the Neo-Lao, attracted her and so many of her friends. "As a young girl, I had found that the past had not been very good, for men had mistreated and made fun of women as the weaker sex. But after the Neo-Lao party began to administer the region, it became very different. Under the Neo-Lao, things changed psychologically, such as their teaching that women should be as brave as men. For example, although I had gone to school before, my elders advised me not to. They had said that it would not be useful for me as I could not hope to be a high-ranking official after graduation, that only the children of the elite or rich could expect that. But the Neo-Lao said that women should have the same education as men, and they gave us equal privileges and did not allow anyone to make fun of us. And the old associations were changed into new ones. For example, most of the new teachers and doctors trained were women, and they changed the lives of the very poor, for they shared the land of those who had many rice fields and those who had none." A 17-year-old boy told about the Pathet Lao Revolutionary Army coming to his village. "Some people were afraid, mostly those with money. They offered cows to the Pathet Lao soldiers to eat, but the soldiers refused to take them. If they did take them, they paid a suitable price. The truth is that they led the people not to be afraid of anything. Then they organized the election of village and canton chief, and the people were the ones who chose them." In September 1973, a former government official in Laos, Jerome Doolittle, wrote in the New York Times, "The Pentagon's most recent lies about bombing Cambodia bring back a question that often occurred to me when I was press attaché at the American Embassy in Vientiane, Laos. Why did we bother to lie? When I first arrived in Laos, I was instructed to answer all press questions about our massive and merciless bombing campaign in that tiny country with, at the request of the Royal Laotian government, The United States is conducting unarmed reconnaissance flights accompanied by armed escorts who have the right to return if fired upon. This was a lie. Every reporter to whom I told it knew it was a lie. Hanoi knew it was a lie. The International Control Commission knew it was a lie. Every interested congressman and newspaper reader knew it was a lie. After all, the lies did serve to keep something from somebody, and the somebody was us. By early 1968, the cruelty of the war began touching the conscience of many Americans. For many others, the problem was that the United States was unable to win the war. While 40,000 American soldiers were dead by this time, 250,000 wounded, with no end in sight. The Vietnam casualties were many times this number. Lyndon Johnson had escalated a brutal war and failed to win it. His popularity was at an all-time low. He could not appear publicly without a demonstration against him in the war. The chant, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today, was heard in demonstrations throughout the country. In the spring of 1968, Johnson announced he would not run again for president, and that negotiations for peace would begin with the Vietnamese in Paris. In the fall of 1968, Richard Nixon, pledging that he would get the United States out of Vietnam, was elected president. He began to withdraw troops. By February 1972, less than 150,000 were left. But the bombing continued. Nixon's policy was Vietnamization. The Saigon government, with Vietnamese ground troops, using American money and air power, would carry on the war. Nixon was not ending the war. He was ending the most unpopular aspect of it, the involvement of American soldiers on the soil of a faraway country. In the spring of 1970, Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger launched an invasion of Cambodia after a long bombardment that the government never disclosed to the public. The invasion not only led to an outcry of protest in the United States, it was a military failure, and Congress resolved that Nixon could not use American troops in extending the war without congressional approval. The following year, without American troops, the United States supported a South Vietnamese invasion of Laos. This too failed. In 1971, 800,000 tons of bombs were dropped by the United States on Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. Meanwhile, the Saigon military regime, headed by President Nguyen Van Thieu, the last of a long succession of Saigon chiefs of state, was keeping thousands of opponents in jail. Some of the first signs of opposition in the United States to the Vietnam War came out of the civil rights movement, perhaps because the experience of black people with the government led them to distrust any claim that it was fighting for freedom. On the very day that Lyndon Johnson was telling the nation in early August 1964 about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and announcing the bombing of North Vietnam, black and white activists were gathering near Philadelphia, Mississippi, at a memorial service for the three civil rights workers killed there that summer. One of the speakers pointed bitterly to Johnson's use of force in Asia, comparing it with the violence used against blacks in Mississippi. In mid-1965, in Macomb, Mississippi, young blacks who had just learned that a classmate of theirs was killed in Vietnam distributed a leaflet. It said, "No Mississippi Negroes should be fighting in Vietnam for the white man's freedom until all the Negro people are free in Mississippi. Negro boys should not honor the draft here in Mississippi. Mothers should encourage their sons not to go. No one has a right to ask us to risk our lives and kill other colored people in Santo Domingo and Vietnam so that the white American can get richer." When Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara visited Mississippi and praised Senator John Stennis, a prominent racist, as a man of very genuine greatness, white and black students marched in protest with placards saying, "In memory of the burned children of Vietnam." The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee declared in early 1966 that the United States is pursuing an aggressive policy in violation of international law and called for withdrawal from Vietnam. That summer, six members of SNCC were arrested for an invasion of an induction center in Atlanta. They were convicted and sentenced to several years in prison. Around the same time, Julian Bond, a SNCC activist who had just been elected to the Georgia House of Representatives, spoke out against the war and the draft, and the House voted that he not be seated because his statements violated the Selective Service Act and tend to bring discredit to the House. The Supreme Court restored Bond to his seat, saying he had the right to free expression under the First Amendment. One of the great sports figures of the nation, Muhammad Ali, the black boxer and heavyweight champion, refused to serve in what he called a white man's war. Boxing authorities took away his title as champion. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out in 1967 at Riverside Church in New York. "Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and a brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours." Young men began to refuse to register for the draft, refuse to be inducted if called. As early as May 1964, the slogan, "We Won't Go," was widely publicized. Some who had registered began publicly burning their draft cards to protest the war. One, David O'Brien, burned his draft card in South Boston. He was convicted, and the Supreme Court overruled his argument that this was a protected form of free expression. In October of 1967, there were organized draft card turn-ins all over the country. In San Francisco alone, 300 draft cards were returned to the government. Just before a huge demonstration at the Pentagon that month, a sack of collected draft cards was presented to the Justice Department. By mid-1965, 380 prosecutions were begun against men refusing to be inducted. By mid-1968, that figure was up to 3,305. At the end of 1969, there were 33,960 delinquents nationwide. In May 1969, the Oakland Induction Center, where draftees reported from all of Northern California, reported that of 4,400 men ordered to report for induction, 2,400 did not show up. In the first quarter of 1970, the selective service system, for the first time, could not meet its quota. A Boston University graduate student in history, Philip Supina, wrote on May 1, 1968, to his draft board in Tucson, Arizona, "I am enclosing the order for me to report for my pre-induction physical exam for the armed forces. I have absolutely no intention to report for that exam, or for induction, or to aid in any way the American war effort against the people of Vietnam." He ended his letter by quoting the Spanish philosopher Miguel Unamuno, who during the Spanish Civil War said, "Sometimes to be silent is to lie." Supina was convicted and sentenced to 4 years in prison.